where we run into that kind of hassle mostly is again in urban America. It's really trying to fight the what I call the rut this country's gotten into with black white civil rights. You know, that attempt to mix. There's nothing wrong with that. We're willing to move and willing to integrate, but we just simply want to retain and maintain what it is that's unique about being Indian. That's a little difficult for people in urban America to understand.
What is your appraisal of the legislative proposals that were made by the administration in 1970?
Well, I had a little to do with writing the president's message in the first place, and I'm still looking for people to help them put that together. The legislation proposed, the assistant secretary's position, the independent trust council, the trespass laws, the takeover bills, and all, in my mind, are really band-aids. The Indian Trust Council with this administration, I just don't see how it could function. You got to have honest people in government in order to allow an independent trust council to operate. I just don't see this administration appointing a guy that would really be an advocate. No differently than when I was there. When I led the House of Water Rights in this country in the position that I was in, you really wind up taking very powerful corporate, economic, and political interests. You can't, any time, when I mentioned Phoenix and Denver and Vegas and Reno and all those cities and Los Angeles, you're really fighting very, very powerful corporate interests, conservation interests, agricultural interests, power interests. And the kind of guys you need in there is you know, the kind of guy like Bill Peter. But this administration would just simply not appoint a guy like that. In terms of assistant secretary, I don't like the administration's bill. I think it's too sneaky. They asked for just an assistant secretary. And be my guess, they'd appoint an assistant secretary for probably like for insular affairs or something or other, and he'd also have responsibility for Indians. The Senate bill is a bill that actually defines and specifically and says we're pushing and pursuing an assistant secretary for Indian affairs. So this is clearly defined. The administration bill doesn't do that. It simply asks for another assistant secretary. In terms of major legislation, I've been proposing for the last year and a half now the thought about creating an independent federal corporation similar to the Tennessee Valley Authority. It really allows for an independent Indian board, allows for the attachment to Congress and created by Congress, differently, for instance, than OEO. Which is an executive office agency. A lot of people have asked for what agency to be attached to the executive office, but I think anybody that understands what's happened to OEO would say that that's not the best route to go. So that I would like that. You've got the text of Congress, you've got an independent Indian board, it allows for interstate activity like Tennessee Valley Authority does, gives you constitutional support. It was based on a situation in a territory that exploited natural resources, rivers that were polluted, and streams polluted, ecological atrocities. But a territory that, for the most part, was grounded in needing a resource and natural resource development, coupled with other kinds of things you find in Yellow Pages, and that's the kind of thing that we need in Indian country.
It must be regional.
It'd be a national corporation, then it could be conceivably divided, into regional kinds of structures. But I think it gives you the kind of protection. I don't like that even independent agency. And I think the other thing I've asked to have coupled with that is a commitment and investment in Indian country very similar to the Marshall Plan for Western Europe. Really long-term financial commitment that really would provide the bucks to do the job. And an organization really governed and directed by Indian people. And I think we could do it. I really do. And you don't need all the rest of the garbage, all the independent trust council and the trespass bill and the right to hire civil servants and already being employed in government, contract for federal service and all that garbage. It's just a lot of garbage, and it's the product of an institution that wants to perpetuate itself and really not interested in the constituents that it's supposed to be serving. And you aren't going to change it. See, I guess what I'm really saying is that there's no way in my mind you can systematically destroy or alter the Bureau. Every institution in this country, the people in them don't realize that the only difference between a rut and a grave is a depth. And most institutions in this country are about 5.5 feet in. And so rather than trying to change them. I think you give them the shovel and finish off the job, then build a new one and use them for fertilizer. You know, so I think I think that's what we got to do. I really do. Yes, ma'am.
Could you review the result of Wounded Knee? I'm afraid I missed something.
Okay, the critical thing in Wounded Knee was one, tribal reform. Two, you're looking at a situation that really questions the integrity, the morality, and the justice of this country. But coupled with that, what I said is a new Indian aggression. It's not comfortable. It's not pleasant. But nevertheless, it's taken that kind of activity to get a response. And the issue there, for instance, talked about maybe even conceivably $200,000 damage. Although I'd have a hard time ever, I used to be in the construction business, to estimate that trading post and those houses to be worth that. The $5 million that supposedly was spent was for all the feds and the FBI people. I was arrested by them too out there. And, you know, for 24 hours a day, but overtime and double time, that adds up pretty fast. So that's probably where the expense was. You know, when you look at Pine Ridge itself, the reservation took place on. You know, Pine Ridge is one of those reservations, first of all, one of the prime users of the relocation program. The statistics are right, there wouldn't be anybody there, but there's been a present 11,000 people there. And it's one of the reservations that's the worst examples of the effects of the Allotment Act, with the alienation of Indian lands to non-Indian ownership. Right now, just Pine Ridge by itself, with requests to reacquire a lot of acreage, needs $200 million all by itself. With airship problems that are so monumental, it'll take another 50 years to do it. So, you know, the equation thing, it's just simply, you know, addressing itself to the conscience of America, recognizing the kind of new kind of aggression that I see in the Indian country. And I'm not saying that that's the right kind of way to do it with guns and weapons, but nevertheless, you know, it's part of the best thing. I think that'll level off over a period of time. But I really took that, and again, I don't think the question there ought to be that the Indians ought to be in court and on trial. I really think it's a question of the government being on trial.
How much of the treaty land do the Indians expect to get back?
Not a question of getting treaty lands back. It's simply allowing us to retain what it is we presently have. Well, considering we're the original landlords, that wouldn't be bad booty.
Yes, I know.
Huh?
I agree that it's you have the right, but how are you going to get?
Well, you know, one thing we're smart enough, we figured out that we recognize only a million and less than 200 million non-Indians. We ain't about to try that. The way that all we really want at this point in time, in asking for instance, for either a Senate, or a legislative commission to review the treaties, is simply to once and for all own up to the commitments made. For instance, in the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 and the subsequent treaty with the respective tribes of the Great Sioux Nation, one of the articles there said that they would provide a house on every acre necessary for every Indian that resided there. Well, they had to be building a bunch of houses at Pine Ridge. The one provision that's not made consistently in treaties across the board are provision for health services. I know only really about 21 times that's been mentioned in approximately 400 treaties. But otherwise, the commitments for providing the funds to maintain viable communities of people, provide the housing, but primarily in every one, providing the educational apparatus and the educational substance to really give the education Indian people that need to really, you know, fend for themselves. And none of which has been done, even to the extent, for instance, that we got to cut this year in education of all places with the $50 million cut in the BIA. When I was in the Bureau, I transferred $6 million out of relocation funds into higher education scholarship assistance. Because the Natural Resources and Trust Services, they systematically have cut funds every year. And that's the guts of the BIA's responsibility. It's not a dispenser of welfare and education, that kind of thing. It was supposed to be created to act as trustee for the private lands held in trust by the federal government for Indians. That's the place where they eroded that responsibility over the years and diluted it. And I just said, they said, you know, nobody does that kind of thing, gives away $6 million. I said, look, I'm not giving away $6 million. I may be buying $120 million worth of fresh lemons. And we thought we had $3 million. Now we went up to 12 and we're back down to 7 again. We've got 14,000 Indian students in college this year. Next year we intend to have about 17,000 Indian students in college. So that they, all we're asking in the treaties is simply that they be respected and that they be, and that the intent and purpose of them be implemented. So it's not asking for you know, the additional sessions of property and that sort of thing. And I think that, you know, it would simply be an exercise of futility to do that, because the Congress does have the right and where the lands have been ceded, simply to either remunerate or to offer similar type lands. Well, there just really aren't that many available lands around that, that could be exchanged for the lands that they might want to acquire. We would like, nevertheless, a preference and a priority in the availability of federal surplus lands. You know, and I had pushed for that and gotten that accepted in the Democratic National Convention. The Republican Convention discouraged our Indians in their convention to do that and to support that. But I still believe that that's a legitimate position to take, that while we have this country honor the treaties on one hand, that Indians really ought to have a first priority on acquiring or selecting federal surplus lands. Yes, sir.
I'm interested in the Indians and Eskimo of Alaska. I'd like to know whether that group is probably concentrated in a very small population, is connected at all with your efforts, or whether they're way off on their own.
No. I had little to do with the suit that the North Slope brought against the federal government. They did it at really my encouragement. Now, it's a coincidence that you asked, because the AFN, the Alaska Federation of Natives, has been just, you know, newly reorganized. Not in the fashion of the old villages that used to be part of the AFN, but now, you know, newly with the 12 regions, a new kind of organization. And they just sent us a little bit of dough the other day for at least a kind of retainer until we tell them what it is they owe us for membership for NCI, which is really healthy to me. They've asked and they want to reestablish the relationship we've had over the years, and they've been, you know, long-time members of NCI, and we've had a lot of relationship. The thing I'd like to say about the Alaskan community is that one thing people fail to recognize in this country is the fact, you know, this gigantic charade that Congress went through to placate, you know, the American public and the Alaska Natives and Indians. You know, $1 billion they talk about, you know, here, Lower 48 represents about half of that in Alaska. And anybody knows that new communities like Reston and Columbia and Jonathan and Minneapolis cost that all by themselves, you know. And the Alaskans are talking about 40 million acres of property that, you know, all of a sudden develop a whole new system of economics and adjust to capitalism, much less to the mentality of America. And neither one is an insurmountable thing all by itself. But the attempt, you know, to use that kind of thing, recognizing little subtle kind of things, like, for instance, the Indians supposed to have first priority in selecting lands. Now, they've got to select 40 million lands. All except that nobody told Congress that the Bureau of Land Management that does the surveying can only do 1 million a year. That's about 40 years, me. Recognizing that they've got to start paying taxes in 20 years, I just don't see them building that kind of an economy to pay taxes. And so in my mind, it's a systematic planned termination of those people, because you and I very well know that those fee-patent lands just aren't going to generate those kind of revenues in 20 years to pay off taxes on 40 million acres of property. And, you know, when you haven't got the dough, you have to give land in lieu of property and taxes. So that was a rig kind of case. It never happened if there hadn't been oil up there. And the amount of money isn't really a very real amount of money to do the job up there. That's really a pittance when it comes to recognizing that, you know, if you were to build a community like Jonathan there, it would cost you twice as much. And to build, you know, the water and sewer systems, for just that alone, they couldn't touch it for the natives up there with $500 million. It just couldn't be done. Yes, sir?
Have any Indians been active in political affairs, particularly outstanding?
Well, yeah. We've got, at this point, at least in state politics now, we've got numbers of things. Alaska now has 6 in the legislature. We've got one in Minnesota now, and we've got three in Arizona, two in New Mexico, you know, and so and it's increasing. This year, for instance, we had Democratic National Convention, 37 Indian delegates at the National Convention. That's about 36 more than we've had in all the history to date. Minnesota, we had 5 delegates, and that's 5 more than Minnesota's ever sent anywhere. And Alaska had the most to do this by 1. So that, in terms of politics, part of the thing you're seeing is that you got to, you know, you recognize, and then Mr. Wistar mentioned, was the federal-tribal relationship. You know, it's never really called for any participating in local, county, or state government at all. That's a whole new kind of process that we're having to pick up. And just the precinct caucuses and, you know, the county and the district caucuses and that kind of stuff to participate in the electoral process. That's a whole new kind of experience. And it's just like you watch the Holy Spirit from urban Indians, you know, the last 5 years or so. The first point of attack was either the BIA or the tribal government for not being responsive. Well, they're really not the enemy. But if you're not familiar with attacking city government, the mayor, or the county government, the county board of supervisors, or the state and the government, you go where you're familiar with. And that's beginning to change, and that evolution is taking place, and I think, you know, you're going to see in the next few years many more unions. You know, like, I'd like to be a congressman, I intend to be. And you know, that's all part of the educational process, and I think it's coming about very quickly. I see it every place. We, you know, we got young, the Indians now, the kids we've got across the country are very, very active, very, very interested. You know, we had a number of them that involved registration in Navajo last fall before the election. We registered 25,000 in a week. You know, we've done it all over the country, registering people, getting young people involved in the political process. A lot of, you know, the 9 out of the 37 that we had, probably the average age was about probably 24 or 25 years old. The 37 went to the National Convention, Democratic Convention. The Republican Convention, they're older because they're all appointed. But you see, it was a different kind of a process. So in terms of state politics and the political process in general, we've got many, many more Indians involved now than we had before. And largely because, you know, if we recognize we have, you know, half of our communities off the reservation these days, that in order to participate and to get some kind of reaction, it takes a new kind of political sophistication in the political, you know, process to get a response. And no different than we've had out of the government. So it's changing. And I think we're going to see, you know, in a few years, many, many more Indians involved in local politics and county boards and city government. See, just like, for instance, if you go across Indian country, you go up to Gallup, New Mexico, there's no reason why Navajo shouldn't run that whole community, or Flagstaff, or Gallup, little town, actually, I can't even name it. But all across Indian country, all the little towns around Indian country that wants to begin to believe that, hey, you know, rather than fight with those clowns all the time, you know, compete with them and beat them. The oldest game in the business. And I think we'll see more of that. I really do. Yes, sir?
Yes, I'm wondering if outside the South can people help the core.
How can what?
People help the core.
Okay, I see lots of reasons. Fundamental kinds of reasons, like just simply being honest. But more importantly, in the electoral process and getting some good honest troopers in there. Keeping up as best you can with organizations like Indian Rights Association that keep up on Indian legislation to know when we need support with bills that we're in favor of and opposition when we're opposed to, you know, given that kinds of legislation. I think at this point in time, the direction of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, for instance, to be brought to a screeching halt. And any expression of opposition to that, you know, we'd welcome with open arms. In terms of suggesting to Congress a new kind of delivery system, a new kind of agency, whether you agree with one of the executive offices of government or one like I've suggested, an independent federal corporation, I think you ought to express that kind of feeling to the Congress, especially to the Interior Minister Affairs committees in the House and Senate and the subcommittees on Indian Affairs. But yet at the same time, you know, in this state, for instance, you've got Congressman Saylor, who's been on the Indian Affairs, Insular Indian Affairs full committee, as well as just been on the House subcommittee. Some things, a lot of times we don't agree on things, but he's been a pretty good advocate. I think in terms of getting information, you can keep on him most of the time, even though he may not be from your particular district here.
Isn't it true that Eastern congressmen may be helpful where some of the Western ones cannot be? For instance, McGovern and Aberest may be knowledgeable and be friendly toward Indians, but they got to be elected by non-Indians, and therefore they would not be as helpful to Indians, perhaps, as some of our Eastern senators where there isn't a conflict of interest.
That's exactly right. The Eastern senators at this, I mean, I should say in congressmen in general, have been great to us. We're in exceptionally good position right now for the first time in history. We finally got rid of Aspinall and out in Colorado. The Internal Minister Affairs Committees have, you know, systematically over the years been headed up and chaired by Western congressmen, and not, again, by accident, but by design. And it's in those Western states that we have our toughest hassles with the Congress, with the House and congressmen, with representatives and senators, with the states, with agricultural interests, power interests, etc. So that, you know, their interests have always been in those kind of things that have been pretty antipodal or opposed to the best interests of Indian country. At this point in time, we've got Congressman Haley from Florida, the chairman of the House Committee. Congressman Haley has been a good advocate for Indians for years. He's an Eastern congressman. He was the most adamantly opposed to the Nominee Termination Act and other termination acts in the middle 50s, even so far as to go there himself to the reservation and say it's a bum deal, don't do it. Didn't quite have the kind of influence, but at least at this point in time, we've got the Nominee Restoration Act back in business, and I think it'll get passed this year if he has anything to do about it. The same is true with the his next in line, Roy Taylor from North Carolina, the same kind of a guy, and you're right, Doc. The if we get more Eastern congressmen on those committees, the better off we are, because that is true. They don't have a conflict of interest, and they've got nothing to suffer if they do great, wonderful things for Indian country. And it hasn't been true in the past, especially with guys like Aspinall and Jackson. But Jackson is becoming a little more liberal bent these days, and so I think we've got something coming. I like Aberest from South Dakota. He's a freshman senator, and he's really got nothing else to hang his hat on. He's chairman of that Indian Affairs subcommittee, so I think he'll want to do something good with it. I always kid him because I was supposed to go to work for him as the counsel to the committee, and I didn't, because I didn't feel like I'd been away from Washington long enough. I just needed some more fresh air before I went back. But we got a guy in there with him now, and I think it'd be helpful to him. Aberest, I think, wants to do the right thing, but I always kid him that he's too impulsive, and before he pulls his guns, he's already got the bullet holes next to his shoes, and he gets up to shoot, he's got nothing left. And hopefully this guy will help him out to do the job better. And we've got, like I said, Indian guys that are now on both the House and Senate committees and much better contacts and much better advocates on the committee. So we've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years. I hated to lose Frank Induciano, for instance. He was a legislative counsel, but I'd rather see him on that committee, and us looking for a new Indian lawyer. So, and we've got some coming up the pipe. So I don't feel so bad in that respect.
This young fellow is very good natured, and he said he'd go on forever if we wanted to have more information, but I think we can't close. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Cook. We all, I think, have been jolted out of some of our complacent ideas and own impressions of what goes on. And we've all been given. I, for one, am very encouraged that the young Indian has still got enough faith in the process of our American government to want to go in to and take part and make his way in American politics. And I think that's very encouraging. We all appreciate very much what Mr. Cook has given us tonight, and I'm sure that we'll all be able to help the Indians more effectively than we have before. Thank you very much, Mr. Cook. And good night to you all.